Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. We are recording this just at the tail end of August. We are finally entering the fall season, and hopefully this heat wave will finally break. But for today, we of course have some game design to talk about. For today's topic, we have a returning guest on to talk about their upcoming game, as well as their thoughts on getting into the early access kind of design for the first time. So please welcome back, fan of Game Wisdom and owner of Serenity Forge, Z.
Hey, Josh, how are you doing?
I am doing great, Z. How are you doing this very hot day, at least where I'm at?
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. It's actually not so bad here in Colorado, but you know, with the eclipse here, it really cooled down, surprisingly. It's actually kind of odd.
Weird. It's still very hot right here. So hopefully there's only a few more weeks left in August, and then we can finally hopefully turn off this air conditioner.
Yeah.
So it feels like it's been a very long time since we last spoke. So how are you doing, or how are things going at Serenity Forge?
It's been great. We've been taking up a lot of different projects. Our team has expanded quite a bit since we last talked. And of course, we're just working on so many different games now at the same time. It's kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm. For those of you who are new listening to this cast, Serenity Forge has put out several games in the past that we've looked at here on Game Wisdom. Let's see, Foresight Fantasy, Luna's Wandering Stars. And did I look at any other games from Serenity Forge, Z?
Pixel Galaxy, I believe.
Oh, yes. And for today, we're going to be talking about your upcoming game, which I believe you said is called Mystic Melee.
Yeah, that's correct. Mystic Melee is kind of a combination of two different genres. It's got a single-player campaign precision platforming, very similar to something like Dust Force or Super Meat Boy, or Mega Man, I guess, if you mash all three together. And then on top of that, there's a multiplayer online mode where you get to play with your friends and kind of play in this arena brawler game, much like Super Smash Brothers.
Cool. But since we last spoke, I know Serenity Forge has been doing more with publishing titles, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. We are, you know, publishing all sorts of games as well, PC, console, where most recently we've been focusing a lot on the Switch. So we're actually, you know, going to be announcing some of those pretty soon. Very exciting. On top of that, we also work on a bunch of other games in terms of development, like The King's Bird, Once Upon a Coma, as well as Where the Water Tastes Like Wine.
Cool. And it's very interesting when we see developers make that switch over to do indie publishing of their own. I guess for you, Z, and Serenity Forge, was it like a very like easy transition to start helping other developers publish their games?
I think it actually was pretty easy, a lot easier than we expected. Number one, I think the reason is because the word publishing has changed quite a bit. A publisher nowadays is not the same as it was 10 years ago. Publishers in the past are the giant companies that, you know, essentially dump resources to make games or make products happen. Nowadays, publishing is way more ambiguous. You see a lot of different publishers. Good Shepherd, one of our publishers for Where the Water Tastes Like Wine. You know, like they are pretty much, you know, all private investors, just a bunch of people who really care about games, run by the people who runs Devolver. And then, you know, you see EA or something like that, where it's a completely different style. So I think, you know, because the term publishing has changed so much, it was really easy for us to kind of craft our own version of what that would mean. And in our case, we utilized some of our strong suits. And because we came from a development background, it was easy for us to offer something that publishers don't usually offer, which is we can just help out and make your game for you. You know, we could jump on your team. You need a programmer. Yeah. Well, instead of throwing money at you to find a programmer, we'll just program your game. You need an artist. We can help out with art too. So that's kind of how we approached it in the beginning. And then on top of that, I think it's just a lot of luck and a lot of, you know, willing to take that risk. A lot of our early investments into publishing, you know, probably weren't the best outcome when it comes to investment. But everyone ended up walking away really happy. We all had a great time working on the different games that we're passionate for, and ultimately that's really all that matters, right?
Mm-hmm. And what's very interesting, I know when we last spoke together, Z, we talked about the challenges of, again, balancing the art and the business when it comes to making a video game. And for a lot of developers, especially first-time indie developers, they can definitely have that trouble, again, of being able to work on their game or be in, like, the weeds when it comes to designing it, and at the same time, managing the business side. You know, marketing the game, reaching out to people, and even just being able to stay on track. And I know perusing around various like indie game forums and Facebook groups, there's still that stigma, I think, that some people have regarding having a publisher. You know, the quote-unquote, you're working for the man kind of thing when it comes to making your game. So I guess, again, as we spoke last time with your background in business, like, what do you think regarding like that kind of stigma that some people have regarding the publishers?
I think that kind of stigma is actually very critical for the publishing labels to change as time goes on. You start to see a lot of these indie games have so much more value in the game industry, and not just like consumer value, but like economic value almost. If you look at games like Undertale making such a huge change, Stardew Valley, you know, such a huge economic change in the landscape. Companies will begin to realize that it's still the developers that actually have the final say in how things go. You know, just to speak from experience, I suppose, from Serenity Forge, we always believe, like, we've always treated publishing as a service to others. You know, instead of, you know, like, developer-publishing relationship, instead of the developer working for the man, it's more so the publishers working for the man, which is the developers. And the man, in this case, I think, is just the creative individuals, right? Mm-hmm. I believe that the developers are extremely creative. They know what they're doing, and they're taking a chance. I mean, okay, they don't always know what they're doing, but they're taking a huge risk. They're taking a chance, and they believe in a strong vision. I believe it's the publisher's responsibility to try to see that vision come to fruition as opposed to try to mold it into something else entirely, like what it's been for the past few decades.
Yeah, and that can definitely be seen, especially in the AAA market, and I think kind of where the stigma has grown from, when you hear stories of a publisher saying, we want to change your game to this, or we don't think this is going to be marketable, you know, remove it, stuff along those lines.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if that game isn't going to work out between the two parties, if you have like different opinions on the game, then maybe that wasn't a deal that was meant to be. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of games out there that I would look at and be like, wow, that's really creative. That's really fun. I love playing it. It's never going to make money, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I was looking at some of the indie Mega Booth games that are announced for PAX West. I saw some of those, especially like, you know, card games or non-traditional type games. You know, you look at it and it's like, wow, that would be so fun to just sit there and play. But, you know, to actually have a true like business model behind something like that, it's going to be really difficult unless if you're approaching it from the Cards Against Humanity or Exploding Kittens kind of mentality.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I agree. There's definitely a push or pull between the developers and publishers. And ultimately, I think it's important for the two parties to align their visions together to have the same kind of goals from the project.
Mm-hmm. And I think what you just said there, Z, is a really good point regarding, and I know we've spoken about this several times in the past, understanding what is a good game versus understanding when you have something that you can build a business model around. And I know we certainly spoke about some of the challenges you had. I think it was either our first or second chat at Serenity Forge of knowing which one of our game ideas can we actually take and turn into something that's marketable versus something that is a good idea, but again, not exactly something that you can put on Steam or Humble Bundle and people would be willing to spend $5-$10 on.
Yeah, I mean, marketing online is especially difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, if you sell something in person at a game convention especially, people are willing to pay for that pretty easily, actually.
Mm-hmm.
We were just selling copies of our games at Denver Comic Con recently, which had a huge 120,000 attendance rate. And, you know, basically anyone who sits down and tries out the game, most of these people are like, yeah, I mean, this is pretty cool. I'm willing to spend money right now to buy the game. Whereas if you sell it online, you know, it's just another, you know, rehash, and
yeah,
no one really cares.
It's the impersonal aspect of it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, no matter how modernized our society is, humans are still going to operate on the fact that we know people, and mm-hmm. and people are what drives trust.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about that, one big thing that happened since we last spoke, of course, would be the change of going from Steam Greenlight to Steam Direct. And for those of you listening to this cast, it's been several months since the actual project or program was rolled out. So for you, Z, again, with your background and doing both indie developing and indie publishing, what did you think about the Steam Direct changes?
So the unfortunate truth is that Steam holds a very strong monopoly on game distribution on the PC right now. Nothing comes close to competing against it. I believe 90% of all digital PC games are downloaded through Steam.
Mm-hmm.
And that's crazy to think about. And physical, in terms of physical game distribution, if you add physical game distribution on it, it's still 80% of all games that goes through Steam.
Yeah.
So there's really not much we could do, I suppose. So because of it, there's not much that we feel very strongly for either. It's just kind of like the sun is out, so you take off your sweater kind of thing. So, you know, Steam decided to do Steam Direct. We're going to change the way that we do things too because of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess in terms of personal opinion, I mean, the obvious comparison here, I'm sure you've heard and felt a lot too as well, is that Steam is just going to be the next app store. They have the user base. They might not have the best support for their users, but they now allow everything. And because of the user base, it's just going to be the place to go now.
Mm-hmm.
The changes would come from curation, right? Steam, I mean, they have their own algorithm, and it's pretty cool. I've definitely seen a few games that I was interested in that I don't think anyone else saw in the past on Steam's front page. But curation is going to be a bigger deal. And that's going to come from all sorts of avenues, Reddit, YouTubers, Twitch streamers, people like yourself, you know, to recommend games. And people are no longer going to be using Steam as their go-to place for buying games or for buying or for being recommended any kind of games.
Yeah. And
you
know, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I basically, you know, it's just, I guess the next step now, what I'm curious for is how the curation world will change. And I think it will be making some big waves. There's going to be new players coming in here to help with that curation.
Mm-hmm. And that was just what I was about to say. The curation side of things and that kind of discoverability issues has always been plaguing Steam, especially when things blew up again in the early 2010s. And with Steam Direct, I think I just remember seeing that news piece, like several thousand games were already like added onto the platform. That's not what you want to hear when you're trying to get your game in front of people. And like as you said, it's going to be very interesting to see how the curating side of things will change in the future. Because again, for someone just flat out or someone just flatly going onto Steam and trying to find a new game, they're just going to be overwhelmed with everything hitting them all at once.
Right. I guess the biggest worry is the Steam turning into a true app store. You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't think the likelihood of that happening is super high, although it's definitely a possibility. Mobile players don't necessarily go out there and look for game reviews and download the mobile games that they want to, you know, they mm-hmm. listen to. They usually go to the app store, look at some icon, and then they download whatever it is that icon looks like.
Yeah, and of course, the featured as well, you know, whatever's on the front page.
Right, and that results in, you know, the top 10 games making 95% of the money
mm-hmm.
in the entire app store, whereas the rest of the 5% is shared by the next, you know, million whatever games out there. So if that's the case, you're probably going to start seeing the quality of games decrease, because everyone is just trying to create, using market data, using statistics to create one of the top 10 games. Mm-hmm. And if they don't make it, they'll just move on to a second try, and you know, large companies, large companies will be able to try that more than small companies, and then eventually small companies will go off and go do other stuff. So if that transfers into Steam, I think that's probably the most dangerous thing.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, when it comes to this kind of discoverability issue, it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. If your game is big enough to get noticed, it's going to stay on the front page and earn a lot more money, and therefore just keep earning and earning and earning. If your game doesn't get noticed right away, it's going to disappear off the front page, and then it basically enters no man's land when it comes to people trying to find it.
Yeah, I mean, you see so many really good games that just disappear into the void. No one ever, you know, sees or hears of them, about them ever again after they get released. But the truth is, I don't think any game really deserves to be in the top 10 either. No matter how good that game is, no game really deserves to be there. I think it's just the amount of fame and fortune that you receive from being in that position drastically outweighs what that game's design merits actually are.
And I know we only have about like 40-50 minutes today, but that's definitely a good hour and a half discussion regarding, again, the whole idea of Steam curation, and even just, I made a post about on Game Wisdom at the time of this recording regarding quality control standards. And these are very big topics, and as we keep saying, they're topics that need to be answered at some point, especially if we want to keep seeing developers try and make those interesting games that, as you said, they don't exactly tick every marketing, you know, box for the top 10 game kind of thing. Now, I guess moving on, let's move into something a little bit more optimistic before we just spend the whole cast on about doom and gloom. So a few minutes ago, you talked about Serenity Forge and going more with the Nintendo Switch. So I don't think we spoke about your thoughts on it when you were last on. So what do you think about the Nintendo Switch right now?
I'm actually a huge buy-in for the Switch. I bought the Switch on release, played Zelda for 100 hours, and then never touched it again. But I really, really, I do love the console quite a bit. So we showed two of our games that we have announced for the Nintendo Switch so far. Once Upon a Coma, as well as The King's Bird at E3 this year. And in addition to that, you know, we're working on all sorts of different Switch projects as well. I just feel like Nintendo has it right this time. I feel like the Wii U was an experimental project that was supposed to lead into the Switch. By holding the two different pieces of hardware, you just know that they know what they're doing. You know, you look at the Wii, you look at the Wii U, you know that they are trying to create a minimal, really cheap product that's easily sellable, and then, you know, try to get it going. Test out the market, see what's the reaction for how these pieces of technology interact with each other. And then you glue the Wiimotes next to the Wii U pad, and then you have the Switch, right? You know, much higher quality. They clearly designed it in a way where it's kind of like a modern iPhone type feel. And it's just a really good piece of hardware. I mean, working with the Switch, I would argue that the Switch is as powerful as an Xbox One. In terms of just hardware capabilities. And there's a lot of, there's certainly some different things about the Switch that have not been yet announced that I think is going to also shock the game industry going forward once they do. Yeah. So I think there's just a ton of potential, very open market, not a lot of games on there right now, and it's only going to get bigger.
Interesting. And yeah, it definitely seems like Nintendo really is, again, pushing that angle of being the outlier compared to the other major consoles. As I'm sure everyone is aware of, being or playing a Switch is very different compared to playing on the PS4 or the Xbox One. And I've definitely been hearing nothing but good things about it. Maybe at some point I can get my hands on to try it out. Because I've been eyeing that Mario Rabbids game of Mario XCOM. That has me very interested.
Yeah, I mean, the Switch essentially feels like a PSP, but that has the same kind of power as an Xbox One, right? Mm-hmm. So you can put it on your TV and play it as a normal console, or you can take it to, on the go if you want to. I actually just played the Switch as a normal console, and it feels great the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Although I will say, Z, comparing the Switch to the PSP, you may have upset a few people listening. I can just sense a few fans just getting sharp pains in their chests from that.
I mean, okay, to be totally honest, this is something that I made a comparison to. I think Nintendo did this viciously. They designed the DS to destroy the PSP, PS Vita audience to the point where Sony has to step out of that game. Then Nintendo goes ahead and designs the Switch to take that market, swoop in. I just feel like that's such a smart business move overall.
Mm-hmm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but have you guys been working with VR? I keep forgetting which studios have been doing more VR and which ones haven't.
Yeah, we have been doing a lot of some VR work. We don't have any commercial products planned for VR, mm-hmm. Mostly because we're kind of sketched out by VR's prospects. I'm pretty public about this. I'm not a huge buy-in for VR, mm-hmm. although I am. We have been developing VR products for a pretty long time. We are one of the first early adopters for the Oculus Rift. Like during the Kickstarter days, we backed it to get a set. I think AR, usually I think about AR and VR. I think I like the AR a little better. VR, we do a little bit of stuff.
Cool. And I know since we last spoke, we've definitely seen the major players come out in terms of VR with the Oculus Rift, the Vive, and of course, PSVR. So it's going to be very interesting to see how things go, because I think I'm in the same boat as you, Z, that I see it as something that's very interesting, but I haven't seen that one VR game that makes me think I won't buy a VR setup.
Yeah, I just feel like VR is just too segmented. Mm-hmm. If anything that's destroying VR is the businesses that are destroying it. I mean, you see the Oculus Rift, which is kind of in the middle. You see the Vive, which is a little better. And then, you know, you see Samsung Gear, and then you see, like, Google Cardboard. You know, you can go the whole spectrum between $10 and $1,000 that you want to spend on a personal VR set. Mm-hmm. And depending on the set that you have, you can only play a limited library of whatever it is made for that quality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if someone makes a Google Cardboard experience, the Vive people are going to feel like they're ripped off. You know, that's not using the hardware at all. But then if you make it for the Vive, then you're only making it for like whatever small percentage of VR audiences out there in the world. There's already not that many people that own VR headsets, let alone only the Vive. So you're already excluding your Oculus and your, you know, PSVR audience.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you see other companies like Microsoft stepping in with their new mixed reality programs, which I believe is actually one of the cooler things I've seen. But again, like the more players there are, the more fragmented it will be, and the less definitive VR will be. Mm-hmm. I think eventually one company is going to win. Like, okay, in order for VR to actually be mass adopted, we need for one company to win in the VR race. And whatever that headset is will be the definitive VR headset. Yeah.
Basically, there needs to be a standard so that the market and the audience knows that this is what I need to buy. Rather than, you know, buying three or four different headsets and not knowing who's going to be the one that gets supported, essentially.
Right, right. I mean, if you look at consoles, pretty much all the games play on, you know, PS4, Xbox One, and then play on the PC. And you only need one to play a bunch of different games. Sure, mm-hmm. there are some exclusives, but it's not because of technology by any means. It's just mm-hmm. because of business deals.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you have, you know, like an Atari, and then you compete that with Xbox One, and then you compete that with a really high-end gaming PC, you know, it's just going to feel weird.
Yeah, definitely. So I think moving on then, I know, again, we're going to try and keep this under an hour. Let's talk a little bit about Mystic Melee. And then I think, again, that will probably take us to the end for today's cast. So for people listening to this cast, again, by the time it goes up, Mystic Melee should be out on Early Access. But for people who haven't heard about the game yet, could you kind of give us like the elevator pitch for it?
Yeah, Mystic Melee. I kind of already talked a little bit about this in, earlier in the show. But mostly, it's got the single player, a mix between a single player and a multiplayer experience. The best way to describe it, I'd say, would be a precision platformer that's also an arena brawler. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it takes a lot of skill to play this game. It takes a lot of skill to be a lot, even more skill to be good at this game. It's a game that can be speedrun, so it's got, you know, speedrunning systems kind of like Dust Force or Super Meat Boy, or you can just play it kind of from beginning to end, a single player, kind of like in a Mega Man setting, where you just go around and experience the story and see the characters and, you know, kind of just beat different levels. And then on top of that, the multiplayer section, it's a four player. Right now we're limiting it to four players. It supports online. It's a multiplayer kind of arena brawler. It has different types of game modes. It's kind of like Towerfall, I guess, is probably one of the best comparisons there. And the different game modes include some sports modes too, in addition to deathmatch, kind of like, you know, basketball type games, 2v2s and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So where did the concept for Mystic Melee come from?
I think the two largest inspirations for Mystic Melee is probably Duck Game, which is kind of like this really crazy, insane platformer brawler, where you just kind of shoot your friends and, you know, have a have a pretty insane amount of time. And then the second inspiration probably came from Dust Force, which is the single player, just speedrunning, perfecting your controls and, you know, knowing what you're doing kind of thing.
All right. So you said, like, with the precision platforming elements, like, could you go a little bit more detail about, like, what's going to, or what are the challenging aspects of platforming when it comes to Mystic Melee?
The game is actually very intuitive. There's nothing special about the controls themselves. You know, you walk, you jump, you double jump, and then you can jump reset if you hit certain things in midair. But very similar, again, to Dust Force in that regard. Mm-hmm. The special thing about the game, I would say, is the spell system. So the game, each character in the game comes with their predetermined skill set, which is pretty generic and doesn't have a lot of specialness in them. I mean, there's some minute differences between the different characters, but the true difference comes from spells that you actually pick up inside the level. So it's kind of like almost like picking up items, but instead of picking up items, you can hold on to two different spells that you pick up throughout every single level, and it completely drastically changes how you play the game. Certain spells would have you cast long range fireballs. And then certain spells would give you invincibility dashes where you just dash around in air or like go through walls or control different blocks and drop them onto your enemies and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So when you're playing a game of Mystic Melee, is it played in like a match style as in, you know, 5 to 10 minute runs? Or is there like an actual like campaign, you know, like a longer kind of gameplay?
So depending on how you play it, single player and multiplayer is drastically different. Although I think both modes use a lot of precision platforming quite a bit. So the multiplayer mode is mostly you can make your own matches. You can just get quick play matches in. I think the layout is very similar to something like Overwatch, where you can, you know, quick play join a game, and then it would be one of multiple different game modes. Right now, I believe we have three major game modes. The first one's just deathmatch, pretty straightforward. You kill everyone, and whoever wins three rounds wins. You only have one stock. And then we have a obelisk mode, which is just capture the point. Whoever stays on the point the longest wins the game. Pretty simple as well. Supports pretty good team play. And then the third mode is Hypersphere, which is kind of that, like this basketball, almost Rocket League kind of game mode. Only the difference is you get to kill each other while you're playing Rocket League. Essentially, you get to shoot at each other and try to attack each other. So, and then there's the Blitz mode, which is the more generic mode that contains all three and just kind of gives you a random mode whenever you play.
Okay. Now, earlier you mentioned that you're designing a game around speedrunning and, like, that kind of community and culture. Could you talk a little bit more about, like, how Mystic Melee will appeal to speedrunners?
Yeah, so Mystic Melee has replay systems. There are four different characters that you choose from, and there's just a ton of different levels from beginning to end. There's four different worlds, five different worlds now, actually. Five different worlds, each with 15-plus levels. Each level has a hidden special collectible as well as just a bunch of different, you know, things you have to touch to get points. Mm-hmm. Essentially, I mean, it's pretty similar to Dust Force. And the way we see it is Dust Force is, it's kind of an abandoned genre of games. Not a lot of people are making games like Dust Force, even though there's a lot of people who are looking for games like it to have fun with, to really feel that sense of intrinsic progression in their, you know, daily lives. And those are the types of games that we really enjoy playing too. You know, the King's Bird is another good example of something we're working on that's heavily inspired by Dust Force. So we just kind of really want to empower players to make it so that, you know, you can play the level once and then you realize, hey, you know, like it says that this is my time. Maybe I could replay it and have a lower time, right? Mm-hmm. And then you kind of lead them into becoming just hardcore gamers who otherwise would never feel like they want to become a speedrunner. This way, you know, they just want to be a speedrunner because it's fun. They're feeling better about themselves.
Mm-hmm. And what you said a few seconds ago, Z, is very interesting regarding Dust Force's design. And I've talked about this before with games that are built around entirely player progression, as in it's about the player becoming better at the game or understanding the rules versus, you know, leveling up your character, unlocking new powers, stuff like that. And it's very challenging to create a game that's balanced along those lines. I know for a lot of people, Dust Force can be very difficult to play. Anyone who's gone or attempted some of like those hidden key challenges or those hidden worlds where things just get absolutely bonkers in terms of the controls or in terms of level design can certainly attest to it. But the challenge and where it becomes polarizing is for a lot of people who play these kinds of skill-focused games, when there is no buffer or secondary form of progression, they can hit that wall of, I can't get any better at this game, so basically, I can't play this game anymore. You know, the game is done for me.
Right, and I think one of the things that Dust Force did amazingly well, and it's something that, I mean, pretty much every game that, every game really should have in the future, I think, is that replay system. You know, you can look at an online scoreboard. I mean, when I first got into Dust Force, I beat the first level in like a minute. I'm like, oh, cool. That's pretty fun, I guess. And then at the end game screen, it's like, oh, here's the top players in the world that beat this game in 2 seconds.
Yeah, it's like, what?
I was like, what? How did that? Yeah. And then I go ahead and, you know, click one of them. It's like, how did he do that? So, you know, and then it replays the whole level of how that person actually did it. And now, you know, I'll go back and like, oh, you know what? I probably can't do that specifically, but I can probably do better than what I did the first time, knowing what that person did. And then I'll go out there and then I go explore and then I shave off 15 seconds on my play. And then, you know, I'll look at another replay or something like that, or maybe move on to the next level. You know, that type of progression just feels really genuine to me. It's not forced. It's essentially the game developers giving the player creativity, right? Giving the essentially it's a sandbox in a way.
Yeah.
Sandbox of progression. You know, a lot of sandboxes you just try to give the player all sorts of things to do to keep them entertained. Well, you don't really need to. You give the player content. You let players watch how other people play and then they try to learn from that. So I don't know. I just feel like that's one of the things that really inspired us.
Yeah, and another major part about that is that the player essentially is given all the tools they are needed to play the game right from the get-go. When you play a game like Dust Force, again, you're not unlocking a triple jump or a super dash. How you play the game or what the mechanics are stay the same from beginning to middle to end. It's just your understanding of how these mechanics work that grows, or hopefully grows, over the length of play.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, that's honestly something that was really hard for me to grasp, actually, when, you know, first starting to design this type of games. You know, I've always grown up playing a ton of different Castlevania and Metroid games, and I've always loved that type of progression in Zelda. Pretty much every, you know, platformer 2D kind of game has that type of progression back in the days. But then if you look back to games like Mario, right? I mean, Mario, you start with the same kind of tools you always had. You pick up power-ups along the way, but you never keep them throughout the levels unless you get deeper into the more gimmicky mechanics. And that works. And why wouldn't it work now? Maybe there is just a more detailed Mario that someone would also like to play.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you have to get going in a few minutes, Z, but one part that I definitely want to touch on with you is the fact that Mystic Melee, when it is released in September, it will be going on early access. And as we spoke just before we started this cast, this will be Serenity Forge's first early access game, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
So I guess for people listening to this cast, especially any developers, what was kind of the inspiration or the reason to develop Mystic Melee through early access as opposed to a traditional game design?
Well, the simple truth is that we just don't have time to finish the game fully by this year before the holiday season. I mean, as you know, your listeners might know, it's pretty much a death sentence for any indie game to release during the holiday season nowadays. So we're trying to avoid that as much as possible. And also, Mystic Melee is a multiplayer-focused game. So we're going to be really heavily pushing the multiplayer to start. Not to say that. I mean, we'll have two different worlds of the single-player campaign as well, just to get people a taste of it. And that, because it's an online game, we want to kind of release it early and start building that audience so that people are going to continue to play it as time goes on. And when we fully release the game, just have that many more players already playing the game so that, you know, people can go online and join games and just have fun with each other.
Mm-hmm. So when the game is released again in September, how long do you expect to stay on early access for?
We're probably planning on releasing a full game early next year.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, so I guess whenever from September until early next year, it's probably when it's going to be on early access for. The majority of the game, I mean, the game is pretty much finished. We just need some more content. We might release a couple more characters as time goes on while it's in early access. But really, again, nowadays for a game to release on early access, it pretty much is the same thing as released, right?
Mm-hmm.
The game is just, it doesn't have enough content for a single player full playthrough of the story yet. We don't want to fully release a game where you can't even beat the game from beginning to end. So that's really the thing that's blocking us at this point. Plus, again, like to try to gauge the early access audience and get some playtesting in and possibly change out some of the game's design during the next few months.
Yeah. And I know this will be an always popular question from fans. When you release Mystic Melee in September, will the price change between early access and when it officially hits 1.0 later in 2018?
We actually had some discussion internally about this. We haven't nailed down anything specifically yet, but we have some conversations about possibly releasing early access much cheaper than the actual game. So if you grab it early access, when the game actually releases, you're essentially saving some money there.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to play it early. So, you know, there's definitely some benefit there.
Yeah, and I know trying to price your game, especially when you're going from early access to retail, that can be a massive discussion. I know it's one we, unfortunately, I don't think we have a time to get into too much tonight.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I probably don't have much to say about it either, because we haven't determined anything and we have no idea what we're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, hopefully we'll release it at a fair price for its early access. And then once the game comes out, it'll be at another fair price for a full game.
Mm-hmm. Do you see it being ported to other platforms?
We don't have any plans for that at the moment. The game is actually not written in Unity. The game is actually purely written in C++ OpenGL libraries. So, you know, we went old school with this one, kind of how traditional game devs used to do things before Unity. But the problem with that is that it's really hard for us to port it onto consoles, actually. We would have to essentially rewrite everything.
Mm.
So we don't have any plans for it yet. But again, you know, if the fan demand is out there, then we would definitely do it.
All right. So I know we are just about hitting like 40 minutes into our recording. So, and I know you have to get going in a few minutes. So I think we'll move into like kind of like my final set of questions and then we'll wrap it up for tonight. So I guess the first one is regarding Mystic Melee's design. Are there any aspects of the game that I didn't touch on that you would like to bring up now, Z?
I mean, this is one of the funniest things about Mystic Melee. It's not really something that's super unique. Mm-hmm. It's just pretty fun to play. It's kind of like if you look at Shovel Knight, right? I mean, not to compare the two games, but we do actually quite a lot internally. Shovel Knight doesn't really do anything too new or too unique. And when you talk about it, all you could really talk about is how good it is and how solid it feels. And that's kind of how I see Mystic Melee as well. It's just a really fun, solid game to play, and it feels good. The controls feel good. It's not written in Unity, so that we never use any of that type of broken physics. So it has a very, you know, like it's tailored physics engine, collision engine, everything. Same with the online system as well. You don't see a lot of multiplayer online indie games, and we wanted to add more to that too. Mm. So I think overall it's just a really comprehensive bundle of design that works well together. Nothing in particular super standout compared to one another that we haven't already touched on. But you know, when you put it all together, it's just a good time.
Yeah. And the Shovel Knight comparison is very interesting because, as you said, Z, it was basically designed from the ground up to emulate classic platformers. So they weren't trying to, I guess, rock the boat in terms of brand new designs, but it feels like a highly iterative version of those games, something that's very polished and, in a sense, greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, totally. I mean, Shovel Knight's one of my favorite games of all time, and I'd be lying if I didn't say that we try to rip off some of their design philosophy. But, you know, like, yeah, I totally agree. It's and if our game could come anywhere near to be compared to something like Shovel Knight, that would probably be, a life dream right there.
Now, one last quick question that you just brought up there, Z, regarding the multiplayer aspects of Mystic Melee. I know for a lot of indie games, especially when the communities get hold of them, there's always that very interesting discussion as to having multiplayer, building, you know, we've heard the classic or that famous complaint, why can't you just have multiplayer? It only takes a week to do it, stuff like that. When you guys were coming up with the idea for Mystic Melee, was multiplayer basically there from the start, or was that something that was added in during the early design process?
Multiplayer online was there in the start, mm-hmm. and it comes from the fact that we knew that not a lot of indie games are trying to do multiplayer online. And honestly, I'm sad because of it, because I want to play more indie games online with my friends who live, you know, on the East Coast, but I can't. And then on top of that, because Duck Game is such an inspiration, that kind of party fun feel, like couch playing fun, you don't really find that very often through an indie game that's online. I mean, there are definitely a ton of different competitors like Towerfall or Brawlhalla or Rivals of Aether. But Mystic Melee is, I would say it's more hectic than any of them. And it works pretty well online, and is, you know, or you can play locally, and it's just tons of different options there. Mm-hmm. And plus you have a single player mode. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it was definitely there from the start, and we wanted to help push hardcore audiences to start realizing their, you know, speedrunning dreams as well.
Yeah, and next time we talk, see, I definitely want to get into a discussion with you regarding kind of designing the multiplayer side of things, because I think that's a very interesting topic. And again, it's one that I think a lot of indie developers want to know about in terms of some of the considerations that go into building that kind of architecture, especially for like a first-time studio or indie developer starting out.
Yeah, totally. That would be awesome. You know, to be honest, I don't know much about multiplayer. Mm-hmm. This is the first multiplayer game that Serenity Forge really kind of like focused on. I mean, Pixel Galaxy had a two-player mode, but that was just kind of, you know, we put it together. There was not too much depth there. You know, we don't have anything too crazy of multiplayer games coming up in the future either. So really, I mean, this is kind of the entirety of my experience.
Cool, yeah. If I forget that next time we talk, definitely feel free to remind me about that topic.
Yeah, totally.
All right. I think with that, I am just about out of questions, at least for today. So I guess here's one last one. For the fans listening, have you started thinking about any other concepts or titles for Serenity Forge, or is it still too early to tell?
Yeah, I mean, Serenity Forge, we always work on different games at the same time. I mean, we're currently working on Where the Water Tastes Like Wine, which will be releasing early next year. We're working on The King's Bird, which is also releasing sometime mid-early next year. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, Once Upon a Coma, which is a narrative, really dark narrative adventure game that we recently announced, will also be coming out early next year. So we have a lot of different projects in the works, and we just... started literally yesterday a brand new about a year and a half long project that we have been talking about for half a year now, and that should be hopefully make some differences in the game in the industry as well on some of the topics that you know people don't usually cover. So really excited to announce that maybe a half a year from now.
Awesome. All right, so I think with that, it is about time to wrap it up for today. For you folks listening, I know this will be one of our shorter casts, but Z is a busy guy, and I don't want to keep him with all those games being worked on at the same time.
Yeah, no worries. Just busy meeting stuff before PAX is happening.
So I guess to end things on, do you have any final thoughts you would like to say or any shout-outs to the fans listening?
I mean, I always say this, but thank you so much, Josh, for providing developers the space to communicate with fans out there, to communicate with other developers as well, and just always there to talk about game design and the more in-depth look at how games are made. I mean, I know that I personally learned so much just from talking to you on these podcasts and talking to other people on the panels and listening to the content that you create. And so it's always just such a pleasure. So thank you so much for doing that.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for the kind words. So, with that said, we are going to end things here for this week's Percepta podcast. Be sure to check out Mystic Melee on Steam. Again, if things go accordingly, it should either be up by the time you're listening to this cast or should be out fairly soon. And if you like to support Game Wisdom, there are several options available. To write a guest piece for the site or be a future guest for any of our casts, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. You can follow me on Twitter at GW Bicer for updates throughout the day, and check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel where you'll find daily videos discussing game design as well as a variety of Let's Plays. And be sure to check out the Patreon. You can find me on Patreon under GW Bicer or Game Wisdom. Your donations can help to keep things going, and we hit some goals, so it'll be more content for everyone to enjoy. So again, Z, thank you so much for coming on tonight. The best of luck with Mystic Melee, and hopefully we can talk again real soon.
All right, yeah. Thank you again for having me.
Not a problem. So thanks again for tuning in. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.